Okay, we're recording.
I want to call the meeting to order. We have all the supervisors on the committee are in attendance. The youth and governance people are not here tonight. Citizens' comments. Do we have any citizens' comments? No citizens' comments. Approval of the minutes from the 9/27 meeting.
Move to approve. Second.
Motion by Supervisor Gens, second by Supervisor Kubicki. Any additions or corrections? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. We have a food share update on the agenda. I think I shared with you an email, and we had talked about this at the executive committee, and I brought it up under the chairman's comments at a previous committee, but we've really never had a report on it. So this will be the first opportunity for the committee to receive a report. There's been widespread fraud reported up in Milwaukee, and of course we just want to make sure where we're at here in Kenosha County. So with that,
if I may, before Adeline starts, last meeting Supervisor Decker raised a good point about getting more information from the sheriff's department that we could then do cross checks and matches on folks that were incarcerated 30 plus days versus potentially still being on food shares, and how we go about doing that. So since that meeting, actually on Wednesday morning, I had a discussion with the sheriff right outside this room, and at the same time Adeline was talking to Chuck Smith, and we've been getting that information. So she's here tonight to just kind of give you a quick overview of what it is we found so far and how we're going to keep moving this forward. So I'll have Adeline take over.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. Since the meeting last week and the newspaper article came out about the Milwaukee County fraud in the food share program with inmates getting food share benefits, I did reach out to Chuck Smith and ask him for a copy of their jail list, and they have been providing that to us since last Thursday. That report comes out twice a day, in the morning, in the afternoon, and the lists have about 800, between 850, excuse me, and 900 names on them. And we took that list that was provided to us and ran it against, excuse me, our computer system. Our computer system is called CARES. And in that system, we could cross-match any names that appeared on the jail list with our public assistance list. Once that was done, we did find there were 59 inmates identified on that list. 19 of those people who were identified on that list had already been closed. Closed. The cases had already been closed. Of the 40 that were left over that had open food share cases, four of those cases were Huber cases. And per food share guidelines, Huber cases are eligible to continue to receive food share if they are providing for their families. And so four of those people were eligible for the food share program. That left 36 cases that were identified as open food share cases. And when we investigated further, we found out that several of those people had been in jail more than 30 days, and that had not been reported to us. And so we took immediate action and either closed the cases in those situations where there were single adults. We have two types. We have many types of food share cases, but some are single adults living alone. Others are people with families. Of the 36 cases that were in jail more than 30 days, 18 of those were single adults. And so those cases were closed down completely. And we determined an overpayment based on the length of time they had been in jail over 30 days. The other 18 were families. And those individuals who were identified as being in jail came off of the food share case. And those cases remained open with the remaining eligible people in the household. Of those 36 cases that we either closed or took the incarcerated person out, generally speaking, there was about a three-month period when they were ineligible. And the amount per case averages, this is an average because the workers have to go in and dig deeper to get the information. It averages about $96 per month per case. And if the average time is 3 months, then we're talking about $289 per case where there was an overpayment.
How much total is that?
Yeah, that total is about $10,400 over that 3 month period. We shut them down as quickly as we could because, based on deadlines, computer deadlines, the October benefits, we asked for this information last week, the October benefits had already gone out. So the earliest we could actually shut down the case or remove people who were ineligible is November 1st, but they get charged for all the months that that individual was in the case. And basically, that was our findings. We are still going through and looking at, we concentrated on food share just for this particular look at the inmate population, but we're also looking at other programs that they may be accessing, including medical assistance, and there is one or two instances where the person was also receiving W-2 benefits. So we are taking care of all those instances of people who were erroneously receiving food share benefits. And we are getting the jail report every week. Starting last Thursday, we got it every day, just so we could sort through and figure out how many people on the list were eligible. But from this point forward, we're looking at it weekly and pulling out those who were incarcerated more than 30 days.
Yeah, that was going to be my concern, is that you set up a mechanism to work together with the sheriff so that we don't have this situation happening. I mean, I guess we're lucky that it was a smaller amount. We could get a handle on it quickly. But it's certainly something where we don't want to throw money at, so in these times. So I just wanted to make sure that there was a checks and balances in place between you and the sheriff, that we're going to continue to monitor that. Okay. I don't want to see that weekly thing fall off, or we get too busy to look at it or whatever. I mean, we got to make sure that stays in place.
Oh, definitely. It's going to remain in place. And we're taking the list of the cases that we have identified, and every week that we're getting the list from the Sheriff's Department, we're doing a comparison of how many folks who were on last week's list continue to be on there, as well as people who are approaching that 30-day mark, so that we can check and make sure that they're...
Is this going to be in your department, held in your department, and
yes,
you're going to be overseeing this?
Yes.
Well, when we have you report back on the update for not really budget time, but we always have the departments come in and give us reports. Mm-hmm. I'd like to make sure that this is a part of that report, so that we can follow up and, as a committee, make sure that we're doing our due diligence too.
Thank you. I could do that as regularly as you.
We like to see you and everything, but we don't want to, you know.
But I don't think annually is enough. I noticed the resolution said annually. I think you need to report more frequently than that. You can determine how frequently.
Quarterly, thirds, whatever.
Yeah, quarterly would probably be
better.
Okay. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank you and your staff for a thorough report and working with our sheriff together to get this rectified in a timely, fast manner. I want to appreciate that. And then I think this thing could get resolved without any kind of resolution coming forward. I think we can do this in-house without any kind of verbal thing hanging over us to get this thing done. And I think you did a good job. It just shows us right here that you and your staff have done a great job. So I just want to say thank you to you and your staff.
And I also appreciate you bringing this, to our attention and making it a priority. Call the Sheriff's Department and get this coming to us on a regular basis. So our goal is to make sure that people who are on assistance are eligible for the assistance. And of course, it's their responsibility to report these things to us. But as you can see, this does not happen sometimes the way it should. And so this is another check and balance that we can use to ensure that at least that population of folks are not getting benefits they're not entitled to.
Okay, on a a broader scope, then maybe you could talk about what we do to prevent fraud in other arenas of the food share program, as well as talk briefly about the Racine. I don't know if there's been any progress on the fact that they were bringing forward a resolution to add some, basically add some forfeiture penalties for people who are not voluntarily, you know, I mean, providing the information like these 36 potentially, if we had a county ordinance, would be subject to some type of a fine, and I think that's what Racine is trying to put in place. So here we kind of expand on those two facets.
And I'll start with Racine. Excuse me. As you probably know, we've been working with Racine to develop the Income Maintenance Consortium. And so as we've been meeting with them, I've at least been asking for updates on their ordinance. And they are still moving their ordinance right now through the approval process. They had to work out many details that they're still working on in terms of once this ordinance passes, who's going to do the investigations, who's going to issue the ordinance, how they'll be enforced, and that sort of thing. When I spoke with the Racine County Human Services Director last week, and then I emailed him again today, he says the ordinance is almost ready to present to the full county board. It went to the Human Services Committee, and they approved it earlier this year, and then they were told to work out all the particulars. And he expects that that ordinance will go before the county board sometime this month for a first reading, and I don't know, in the second reading. But their goal is to have this ordinance in place by next year, hopefully by January. And what they would do is when they discover instances of people who have not reported something, they would hit them with a fine, a $300 fine, as a deterrent to not purposely fraud the system. They haven't sorted out yet who's going to actually do the investigation. I think they were having a conversation with the Sheriff's Department, and I don't believe the Sheriff's Department thinks this is a priority for them. And so their plan now is to hire two retired law enforcement people to actually do the investigations for them. And then the cases will be taken into court, and either the district attorney or the assistant district attorney will prove that the case was actually fraudulent. Because when you're dealing with issues of fraud, we may consider it to be fraud, but it has to be proven, you know, in a court of law. And once it's proven, then they can issue the $300 fine. And so that's kind of where they are at this point in time. It's in the works, and they hope to have it in place by next year. And if we decide to do something like that, they have offered that we could use their two retired law enforcement people at a cost, of course, to do our investigations.
That's nice.
So we're still in discussion, and that's where that stands. In terms of the second part of your question.
Well, continuing on with the first.
Okay.
If there are any questions on that. But what does the state allow? You in the email, I don't remember, but you said... Mm-hmm. You know, you thought it might be a little bit of overkill because the state does allow some type of penalties for fraud.
Within the program itself, there's this thing called intentional program violation. And in a situation where we think a person has purposely reported information incorrectly, income, household members, that sort of thing, we also can refer them for what is called intentional program violation, and we have to take them to a hearing. But the hearing would be before an administrative law judge. We would bring our evidence, they would bring, you know, their evidence, and then the administrative law judge, a nonpartisan party, would say, yes, this is an intentional program violation. And if it's deemed to be an intentional program violation, the person is barred from the food share program for 1 year. The first offense is they're barred for 1 year. If it happens again, they're barred from the program for 2 years. And if it happens a third time, then they're barred from the food share program for a lifetime. So there is, within the food share system, already a system to address intentional program violation, which is essentially fraud.
Can we ever pursue that?
We have done it, to my knowledge, very, very infrequently. To my knowledge, we've done it once. And at this point in time, we have one other case that we are going to bring before an administrative law judge, person that we discovered was selling her food share benefits on Facebook. And so we are in the process of taking her to a hearing.
Was that proffered to the district attorney for prosecution? That seems pretty aggravated.
No. We're doing an intentional program violation with her. So we haven't taken it to that point in time or that place yet.
That would be criminal. What they're talking about in Racine, that's a civil forfeiture, but this other is a criminal violation if you referred it and they thought there was sufficient provable evidence.
She hasn't responded, of course, to any of our communications to her.
That's pretty aggravating when you're trying to sell it on Facebook.
One of her friends turned her in.
Probably an ex-friend, though.
One of her friends.
Oh, I get it. See, I need my kids to explain all that stuff to me. Good call.
Any other questions on this? So I guess for me, if, I'm not an attorney, but
sure.
If you're not pursuing, the ability that you have now to penalize those, why would we pursue it if we had a civil ordinance for $300? I don't quite understand what would be the difference. I mean, I don't see the. I guess what I'm trying to say is what's the point of putting a $300 civil forfeiture on the books if we're not pursuing? We've only done two in, as far as I can remember.
I think it's because it's not that we haven't attempted. But when you bring it to the point of the administrative law judge, for example, I believe they overturned the decision and they did not deem it to be intentional program violation. And so you have to prove criminal intent in these situations.
You wait for the civil ordinance as well, wouldn't you?
Yes, you would. Yeah, absolutely.
If I may, most of these cases get settled with overpayments being just directly taken out of the food share amount that that family would be given. So if someone comes in and we discover, like in these cases of the inmates, that a resident in that household is in that home and that household is still eligible for benefits, we just deduct the amount from their food share check that they would get, or a food card that they would get every month in order to, until that repayment is made. So that's generally how these handle. It's not that we just say, oh, don't do that again. We say, now you're going to have to pay back, and it comes out of what your benefit amount is.
So of this $10,400, is that going to be repaid in a fashion such as that?
Mm-hmm.
Even the single people? Because they're not going to be getting it anymore.
Yes, they will be charged with an overpayment. They will get an amount that they owe us. And they can either pay it back in cash, or if they... let's say at some later point they are eligible for food share benefits, we can deduct an amount up to $20, depending on the amount that they're getting. If they're getting $200 a month in benefits, we can deduct about 10% of what they're getting until such time as the overpayment is totally paid off. And, as far as the ordinance goes, I think Racine County is trying to imitate a similar ordinance that Brown County has in place. They have had this ordinance in place, I think, for 2 years now. They started in 2010. And we've reached out to them, too, to find out, how effective it has been. And they said that they have, over the two-year period, I think, issued 14 ordinances and collected on very few. It's very staff-intensive for, what you get in return for it, so... Racine wants to try to do that, and we could do the same thing.
Any other questions on this aspect? We'll go to the other part of the question, which was globally? What other things are we doing for fraud to prevent frauds?
And we have Bob Sood here. Bob Sood is there. Who is our actual, we call him the fraud specialist, but basically when people come in and apply for benefits, there are a number of questions that are asked. What we try to do, what staff tries to do, is identify problematic situations. If a person comes in and presents himself, they've got $1,000 as a mortgage expenses, for example, but they claim no income. There are red flags that come up for workers, and they ask a lot of questions, and they don't necessarily give folks benefits without getting some type of satisfaction to their questions being answered. We also have a number of tools available to us, like the state data match, people who come to us and say they're not working. Over the course of time, their Social Security number cross-matches with a state data match if they're receiving income, if they're receiving Social Security benefits. We have a number of tools available to us that can help us identify situations where people have not been or have been less than truthful with us.
Do you use the tools regularly, or are they just available to you?
No, we use them regularly. What happens, though, is the data matches are behind schedule, meaning we may get information from the first quarter reported to us in the third quarter of the year. So by that time, if a person has not told us the entire story, by the time the third quarter comes around, we get the first quarter information, and it shows that they've been working or they've been receiving some other type of income, unemployment, whatever. And then we either suspend the case because we want more information, or we, in some instances, can close the case. But there's many tools that the workers have available to them that they can kind of keep on top of these situations. We rely on folks to tell us the truth and to bring in actual documentation of their situations, but some people don't provide the information accurately, and so we have to rely on our other tools. So we're constantly trying to stay on top of the situations.
If I may add just one thing real quick. Mm-hmm. The state has always given us very limited dollars to assist us in investigating fraud, and I believe the amount that they put forth in 2011 was about $26,000. Kenosha County decided to join what the state was going to put together as a, you know, any county that wants to join the state's plan, they'll put together the vendor and they'd be accessible to us to assist us in actually doing fraud investigations. Well, this is October. We still don't have anybody named from the state to do those investigations for us. So we're going in a different direction in 2012, especially with our consortium plan that we'll have with Racine. So that's been kind of frustrating also.
Yeah, we used to actually have a fraud contract with a private detective agency, and the state reduced the fraud funding significantly. And like John said, they offered to provide a vendor for us, and to this, we check with them on a regular basis. Do we have a vendor? Do we have a vendor? And they, as of last week, did not have a vendor, and so we're going to, as John said, find a vendor tomorrow.
Sheriff's Department used to have a fraud unit. Is that gone?
They never did fraud for us.
Child support, I know. Yes.
Fraud?
Mm-hmm.
SIU.
Yes, at one time, it's been a number of years. Mm-hmm. We did work with the Sheriff's Department as well as a private investigative agency.
Was that Sheriff's Department unit abolished?
SIU is a special investigative unit.
It was what? Yeah.
Yeah, that's the SIU units have gone from the job center. Oh.
Okay. So was that the job center?
Yeah.
Correct.
So I get this right. Mm-hmm. So the state put aside a $26,000 that we could use, and they were supposed to assign somebody to do this fraud investigation.
Yes,
but they never did.
Investigation.
So the $26,000 really hasn't been even spent.
Correct. And we most recently are in conversation with the vendor on our home to use this $26,000.
Okay.
hire someone to do that.
Well, we could contribute towards receipt fee. Any other questions? We got about 5 minutes left. Anything else? Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other business that would be authorized by law? Seeing none, comments from the committee members. The only one I want to mention is remind you that on October 19th, which is a Wednesday, there's a 5 o'clock gathering for some light food, but a 5:30 meeting, and it's a joint meeting to go over the county executive budget, and it's a joint meeting with the Human Services Board. So they get to present it to both of us at one time. So everybody make sure you mark your calendars. Anything else?
No.
Motion to adjourn.
Second.
Motion to adjourn by Supervisor Gaines, second by Supervisor Decker. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye.